Okay, I think we are ready to get started. Welcome to our three-part series of workshops for business owners. These are essentially for anybody wanting to build their business and either sell or create liquidity. And their workshops are led by a pretty cool brain trust that has over the years helped thousands of business owners. We've got the president of IBA. That's a firm that has completed over 4,000 business transactions. It's actually the oldest business brokerage firm in the Northwest with Gregory Kofsky, and we have Addie Roberge, who I've known for a while. She's the SVP of Heritage Bank. It's a community bank and an SBA lender, and they've got over 90 years of history locally. And myself, I'll make some comments as well. My name's Aaron Scannell. I'm the CEO of Heritage Wealth Advisors. It's the number two ranked wealth management firm in Washington State, according to Forbes. So I'm excited for these workshops. Each of our three firms has drawn, for the content of these, we've drawn from thousands of cases. We're going to share with you the top considerations you should have ahead of a sale. So top strategies for maximizing the eventual sale price of the business, and also minimizing the taxes due. And we'll get into some case studies of companies that have worked through very successful exits. And even if you're not planning to sell in the next several years, we're going to be talking about some techniques that, in some cases at least, they need to be executed years in advance before you sell, so that when you eventually do sell, you have more control of the ultimate outcome, particularly with some of the tax techniques. So there's a lot of advice out there for how investors can exit successfully. There's less for entrepreneurs in the trenches, and we've just seen the spectrum. We have seen some entrepreneurs suffer some frustrating losses, but we've also seen the coveted 10 baggers, as they call them, industry speak, for 10 times return on investment. And again, we're going to share some good factors that can make for better exits. So part one's today. We're going to cover what's my business worth and how do I maximize its value. I don't know that I've ever met an entrepreneur who's not interested in knowing what their business is worth. So we'll talk about how to value the business, how to drive a higher value for the business by creating a marketplace and demand for it, and then how to strategically plan for a smooth transfer of ownership. And then part two is on May 5th. So next month, that one covers strategies. That's going to be more devoted to strategies for keeping the taxes possible, because what we talk to clients all the time about it, it's not about how much you sell for, it's about what you can keep after taxes. And we see a huge variance of what sellers pay in tax, sometimes in the same industry. So we'll get into specific and tangible techniques used by some of the top legal and tax teams to reduce what sellers pay. So we'll talk through things like Section 1202, Qualified Small Business Stock, and that's the one where you have the potential for a $10 million exemption from tax. There's also Code 453A and the potential 30-year deferral of tax. There's also Opportunity Zones, Avoiding Capital Gains Tax, ESOPs, Dynasty Trust, Delaware Trust, Capital Gains Bypass Trust. There's a lot of these tax strategies, and that can seem like it gets to a too technical level, but when the result can mean saving, in some cases, hundreds of thousands or millions in tax, most entrepreneurs we find perk up at the potential for that. And then on June 10th, we'll do the third one in this series, and that'll cover transitioning from business ownership to the next age. And we'll get into the thing that a lot of business owners don't spend much time thinking about until they exit, which is what's next. And that's important, because so many business owners, there's a lot of data that shows business owners often have regrets about their exit. And we'll talk about what the main source of those regrets has been for the majority of business owners, and what actual business owners have said they would do differently in order to avoid having the regrets that they had. So we'll also get into how to turn the proceeds of a business sale into passive income streams that are sustainable and reliable despite recessions, and that grow and outpace inflation over time. So awesome lineup of content, and even better speakers with Addie and Gregory. So I'm excited for this. We'll start with something that very few would have predicted a year ago, which is that valuations are at record highs for businesses. When the pandemic started and the panic was at its high, and you know, and the recession turned into the steepest one of all time, volatility got to a fever pitch level, and a lot of Americans thought the markets would collapse, and so they sold their investments, you know, their retirement accounts. They often sold really good companies. So they might have sold some companies or investments that were struggling, but they also sold good companies, healthcare companies, product companies that were still making money throughout COVID. Things were just really, really bad, and the outlook was predicted to be even worse. And yet here we are later with valuation multiples for business owners being at peak levels and some businesses selling for the highest prices of all time. And this is unusual because valuations are generally cyclical, but they've continued on this steady rise since the Great Recession, you know, in 2008 to their highest in recorded history. And in most cases, small businesses are given, and mid-sized businesses are given a business-specific multiplier of somewhere between 1 and 4 would be the common range. And the multiplier can be impacted by, you know, geography, the risk of the industry, a number of things related to your business. And the multiples vary by industry. And I know, Gregory, you've got a ton of experience with multiples and how they vary, not just on industries, but often for companies in the same industry. So maybe talk through this a little bit for us.
Certainly. So thank you for the opportunity to participate and share information. Multiples are one part of the equation in business valuation. So the two components, the first one is profitability of the company, and that can include adding salaries paid to ownership. They can be either excessive, many times if it's a C corporation avoiding double taxation, they'll receive high compensation forms of salary, which may be above the market value for that position. And then other times people are totally funded in Social Security and maybe have an S corporation and they'll understate their value. So you want to normalize salary for ownership, added benefits, non-reoccurring expenses, and come up with one pot as far as the advantage of ownership. And then you combine that with an industry-specific multiple, which takes into account the competition in this space, the desirability or potential in this space, the industry trends, the clarity of the financial records, the infrastructure in place from technology to staffing. And that's why we see a range in even individual industries where picking on the hospitality industry, we have done as a firm 2 transactions already this year in that space where many people would think it would be a fire sale. But both of those transactions occurred at strong values based on other elements related to the business model that showed resilience in the money in the market. You may have just read in Capitol Hill, we sold a prestigious, beloved sandwich shop, Honey Hole, which now is expanding under new ownership to additional locations. So even in the most damaged industry, opportunities exist.
And Gregory, one thing I would make note of is just the fact that on the lending side of things, there are so many buyers out there looking for businesses to buy. We find that they're hard to come by, and when they find that business, it's a battle to get on that purchase and sale agreement. So just on that side, activity is very strong, and valuations have been coming in or above LOI.
Yeah, those are good points, because people keep asking, it's like, how could businesses be worth more post-pandemic or during a pandemic? And it ends up being a pretty simple answer. It's supply and demand. So you think of from the demand side of the equation, demand is at record levels, because as of middle of last year, private equity right now had, or then had, $1.2 trillion in dry powder, so just money in cash. And the Fed has kept interest rates low, and the low interest rates help increase the availability, like Addy will talk about even more, of financing. And it's sort of like with home prices. It's cheaper than ever to go buy a house for each dollar that's purchased because of the low interest drives that historically has always driven prices up. And, a recent study showed that most business executives, 56%, believe that M&A will be a leading strategy for growth post-COVID. So that's up from 32% prior to COVID. So people want M&A to be a bigger part of their strategy, and that's driving valuations. And then corporations, not just private equity firms, have cash. Corporations have $4 trillion in cash to deploy. And Americans, just normal people, we all have more money sitting in bank accounts than ever before, literally in the history of the country. And then you think of, so that's the demand side. And then on the supply side, there are fewer quality companies for sale. Some on the sideline for various reasons. So they might be dealing with a COVID impact, or like Gregory was talking about, folks in the hospitality industry or industries that got impacted more by COVID might just have this thought that this would be a horrible time to sell. And so they're doing the wait and see approach, when in reality, this for a lot of people is a good time. And while driving a good value for the business is a priority, thinking about what's next is important too. The recent data shows that even the most affluent and successful founders end up struggling with a similar problem, which is the regret of how they handled leaving their company. They don't necessarily regret selling the company, but they regret how they handled it. So a question we'll talk more about in the third workshop in this series is how personally ready you are for what should be the happiest day in your life. We'll talk about the four major drivers of an exit without regret. So one has to do with the future vision. So it's essentially what do you plan to go do after you leave your business. Second one's personal detachment. It's like, have you built a fulfilling life outside of the company? Third is structuring flexibility. Fourth is team involvement. So making sure employees are treated well upon the exit. So we'll cover more of that in the third workshop. But today, it's, again, focusing more on driving higher valuations for your business and the things that go into a financially successful exit. And a primer in financing is a good place to start. So this is where Addy's expertise shines. So maybe you could share a bit more about the various ways companies can be financed by a buyer and how that can actually result in a pretty wide range of valuations.
Oh, you're on mute.
Did we lose that, or is it on mute? There we go.
The infamous mute button. Okay, so my role, again, is SBA lending. I'm on the banking side of financing these types of transactions. So on that front, you know, there are a number of ways to get these deals done. Really, the size of the transaction really drives the way that it can get financed, the size of the transaction and the type of business. SBA lending is commonly used to finance a business acquisition. There are some limitations as it relates to size. $5 million is the cap on this lending program. We often use a combination of buyer cash and seller financing to get the deal done. So I would say on the top end of the range, we are at about $7.5 to $8 million for a project size. Granted, we do smaller deals as well, $500,000, again, up to about $7.5 million. 10-year term financing, that's one of the benefits to SBA lending, along with lower down payments. So SBA lending is tied generally to leverage lending on longer term financing. On the conventional side, these are loans done through banks, community banks, regional and national banks. These are primarily shorter term loans, I would say between 3 to 7 years. Cash into the deal and seller financing both come into play. A reason why somebody would go with a conventional loan is because the cash flow is very strong, or the balance sheet is very strong and it can warrant a conventional loan without having that SBA guarantee fee or guarantee mitigate the leverage on the balance sheet. Private equity is also another way to go. These tend to be larger transactions. I tend to think of high risk, high reward. You get an investor to come in, buy part of the business, implement a growth strategy, and then sell on the larger market. And again, seller financing is always an option. We see this maybe if the buyer doesn't have enough cash to come in to the deal, or maybe the seller wants to stay on for some reason or another and they get interest income, right, off seller financing. So it's a way to get the deal done and for the seller to get some interest income off of the transaction. Performance-based component, there's a few different ways to get this type of financing done. And I might, Gregory, if you or Aaron want to talk about this along the stock gap.
Sure, I'll step in for a moment. And the thing to step back to first on how deals are financed is to identify the different types of buyers. So you have entrepreneurs or high net worth individuals leaving the corporate world. They tend to be more in this SBA lending tranche for acquisition. Then we will have private equity or companies looking to acquire businesses for strategic growth. And they tend to be more in the conventional lending, private equity, and performance-based section. I will touch on private equity in that, A, money never sleeps, and Aaron knows that better than most, and entrepreneurs are very resilient. So they tend to engage quicker, and private equity is buying smaller companies than I've ever seen them buy in my 28 years. And part of that is the tools shown by COVID, which was already happening before, with virtual management opportunities that you don't need to be in the same geographic area to effectively run a company. I will touch on seller financing briefly, but on the buyer side, that is also, there's motivation to do that to make sure the seller remains engaged for transition training and honoring a non-compete. But getting to the performance-based component, this is actually a very important component today in that when we value a company, we may look at 2019 and it was doing fine. And then it had a dip in 2020 based on COVID. And so we need to develop a methodology to deal with what is being sold, because a buyer doesn't care what it did historically. They care what it does when they buy it. And if 21 or 22 looks like 19, the valuation should be reflective of where the company was. And so an earnout or profit sharing or royalty component can help balance the transaction so that the buyer pays a fair price and the seller has fair compensation for what they built. And then I will touch briefly on a royalty. Right now we're working on the sale of a consumer products company that is going up dramatically. So in 2019, it had $1.5 million in sales. 2020, $3.8 million. This year is anticipated at $6 to $8 million. So a deal element that is built in a transaction like that is, how do we address from a valuation perspective a company that'll do eight figures probably by 23 and is a fair deal term for both sides? And I will step back and let Aaron cover the stock swap piece because he's dealt with that for clients in the past.
Yeah, so the royalties, Mr. Wonderful's favorite, right? Shark Tank. And then stock swaps are becoming fairly common where it allows a buyer to, in some cases, offer a higher price because they don't need as much, they don't need to take on as much debt. So they would swap the stock or the ownership interest of the seller for interest in the buyer's company. So a lot of sellers are willing to do that. You may or may not be willing to do that. But some want to keep skin in the game in their industry and like the acquirer, the acquiring business, and want to participate in the continued growth of what they believe to be the continued growth of that business. So stock swap can be really helpful, especially given that if structured correctly, if it's done right, you can have it be tax-free. There can be a tax-free, as they call it, a tax-free reorganization, and there isn't any capital gains tax or income tax due to the seller on the component that is swapped. So there's a big tax favorability to that. So, Addy, maybe you could speak to how the debt service coverage ratios, you've talked about how that can be a good cross-check on the valuation of businesses, and just those are, these are the two that you've talked about being most important, right, the ratios?
Yes, exactly. Oops. Am I echoing there, or am I good on your end?
I don't hear an echo.
Okay. So the debt service coverage ratio is primarily tied to cash flow. So is there enough cash flow coming in to service the debt? Ultimately, I feel like if a deal is well vetted through a broker, the buyer and seller have had their accountants look at the transaction. Usually this is kind of just a check the box. Because we ultimately, you know, the buyer wants to make sure there's enough cash coming in to service the debt and to return equity at the end of the day to recoup their investment. The funded debt to EBITDA is kind of the inverse of the debt service coverage ratio. Basically, we just want to make sure that the company's balance sheet isn't too leveraged. And I want to bring these up because these also can tie into how the seller financing can be repaid. And Gregory had a good point that seller financing is a great way to have basically the seller's feet to the fire, to keep the seller engaged, to ensure the transition goes smoothly. I had a deal in my earlier career where the buyer had basically said they were interested in seller financing. Seller was not interested. We ended up getting okay with that because the buyer had cash to contribute toward the purchase. Well, lo and behold, the seller actually moved to a different state and started the same business and took some of the intellectual property with them. I feel like if we would have had seller financing involved in that transaction, that probably would not have happened because that seller financing can be a way to negotiate in the end. So I don't really want to belabor these ratios too much, but it's mainly just to be aware that there are certain metrics that have to be hit, and on an SBA lending basis and conventional lending basis, a bank will traditionally test these ratios as the years go on to make sure that the business owner is keeping enough equity in the company. And as it relates to a buyer and a seller within the realm of selling a business or buying a business, there's some things that you just want to be prepared for. First is the buyer is all in. And I'm not talking about children, but I'm talking about personal guarantees. If they have equity in their home, that may be on the table as well. So it's just something to be aware of that if you're looking at financing a business through a bank, whether it's SBA lending or conventional lending, the buyer is going to be all in. Seller financing is looked highly upon, as I mentioned. It helps keep the seller engaged in the transition to make sure that that is successful. Give yourself time. I generally say when I start talking with a buyer, they're negotiating an LOI, I usually say give yourself 90 days. We can get a deal done in 45 days, but if there's still negotiations going on between buyer and seller, they're engaged with their attorneys, there's a broker involved, escrow agent, I usually say 90 days is a good rule of thumb. Granted, it could take longer depending on how the negotiations go. And ultimately, just be prepared. The bank is going to ask for certain things. We want to make sure that you've thought through the transition plan, that you have projections to show that you have thought about the cyclicality of the business, any type of operating efficiencies that will come into play post-closing, any additional hires, expansion as it relates to real estate, or even not renting real estate, because we know that within the commercial real estate market, that industry is changing. So with a change of business, it might be a good time for the buyer to renegotiate on that lease and recoup some savings post-closing. All right, so how bankers think. You want to get in my head here. Consider your audience, because ultimately you're looking to the bank to finance the transaction. When I look at a deal, when my credit team looks at a deal, we look at the consistency within the financial trends. Year over year, how much did revenue grow, decrease? Where were the margins at? How did they compare to the industry at large? All bankers know that 2020 is an outlier, and we're prepared for that. But be prepared to talk with a banker about that, about COVID, and how it impacted the business, how the business weathered the storm. We're actually, and I think obviously it makes sense if I say this out loud, but we're looking at quarter over quarter, Q1, 2, 3, and 4. We're wiping out Q1 and Q2 because of COVID. And ideally, we'll see then in Q2 and Q3 of 2020 that the business recouped, because if we look at the year end of 2020, there could be a big net loss. But if we really dissect the numbers, we can look to see the impacts of COVID and isolate when that happened and when the business was able to get out of that situation. One thing I like to remind people, at least on my side of the table, I represent the buyer. We have often at the bank, we have an existing business that's looking to sell, and maybe the buyer is in the company working, or maybe they're an outside buyer. Well, when you work with a seller, that can be a little bit awkward for the buyer, because they tend to think, who is the bank representing? And also, while the business is successful today, maybe the owner is a very strong guarantor, has a net worth. When the buyer comes in, maybe they have a modest pension. Maybe they don't have all of the experience that we're looking for. So it's just one thing to kind of step back and say, who is the buyer? Because that buyer ultimately is going to be the one signing on the dotted line and managing the business post-closing. And ultimately, you know, banks try to mitigate risk. I feel like it sounds tacky, but it's true. We look to do that. And so just keep that in mind if you're working or preparing a package to apply to a business. Take a step back and just say, you know, what are the risks here to a third-party investor? How can I potentially mitigate them? And I would say just as it relates to deal structure, the SBA guarantee helps mitigate some risks because the SBA offers a guarantee. It's like insurance. Right now, the SBA is offering a 90% guarantee of a loan amount, whereas in normal economic conditions, that's about 75%. So the SBA guarantee helps mitigate risk. Cash into the deal helps mitigate risk. Additional collateral. So those are the things that we look at when we're looking at a transaction and financing it. Okay, I think I'm going to take this one here. And Gregory or Aaron, please step in. So how businesses are sold. There's really three primary ways to get a deal done. First is an asset sale. Basically, we have an existing business. We have an allocation towards the purchase price, $500,000 towards equipment, $200,000 towards inventory, and another $200,000 toward goodwill or non-compete. We then, the buyer then forms a brand new entity, gets a new tax ID number, and then they have a DBA, the doing business as, all the trademarks that the business that they bought has, and they transfer over. A benefit to asset structure, there's a few of them. The first is that the buyer gets to step up the value of equipment. So basically, it's the accounting method that allows the business or the accountant to step up the value so that the buyer can depreciate the assets over a longer period of time. It also breaks liability because the buyer is forming a new entity. They have a new tax ID number. If there's any skeletons in the closet, there's that break there that happens. A stock sale, on the other hand, basically the entity stays intact. You keep the same corporate name, the same tax ID number or EIN number. There's a corporate resolution that happens at closing and a change of officers that occurs. So basically, the stock is sold in that situation. There's certificates that get transferred over. The downside to this potentially is that if there are skeletons in the closet, say a past HR issue that the buyer wasn't aware of, that individual could potentially come after the business itself. The benefit, there are a few in this situation. The first is if the business has contracts in place. Those contracts basically stay intact because the entity stays intact, so the buyer doesn't have to go back and renegotiate those contracts. The other is from a tax perspective. The stock acquisition transaction tends to be more lucrative for the seller. And so sometimes we'll even see that the stock acquisition price is less than that asset acquisition. And of course, if anybody else has anything else to add to that, please pipe in. The third is the 338H election. It's an accounting method. I will say that I've spoken with a lot of buyers, and the intent was for this to happen, but for whatever reason, it just doesn't. I don't know if it's lack of professional support on the accounting side or the attorney side to structure the transaction appropriately, but I actually just closed on one of these. And basically, it starts with a stock acquisition, and then it flips to an asset purchase. It was a personal injury law firm that we financed. And there were a number of different cases in the works, and it just made it easier for the buyer to successfully acquire and step into those cases. And there was a tax benefit in taking that 338 election. Gregory or Aaron?
I might jump in for a moment and just talk about a couple things. So the first thing you need to look at is our goal is always to get the parties to yes in a win-win transaction. So the structure of the deal is a negotiated element, and it depends on a variety of things. And this is where having the right professionals advising you, from your CPA to your attorney, to a legal banker, to a wealth advisor, really helps. So you take an asset acquisition, which is the dominant type of transaction in the market, but then you drill down and you need to look at what type of entity it is. Because if it's a C corporation, then you have double taxation issues there, and there's a reason from the seller side to push it toward a stock acquisition. The same thing on the buyer side with the stock acquisition is it can be driven, as Addie touched on, by contract. We sold a company that manufactured products for the nuclear industry and the Navy. Well, you don't want to go back to the federal government and have to revisit a multi-year contract. So a company like that, both buyer and seller acknowledge that the value of a stock acquisition, which results in a stepped-up basis at acquisition, but there are also ways to carve out personal goodwill, personal non-competes, consulting, and get tax benefits. So I can't emphasize enough, whether you're on the buyer or seller side, having the right advisors in the room, because there's no replacement for experience and knowledge in a transaction.
Gregory, I think it's for you.
Certainly, unless Aaron wants to talk briefly in the interim here.
No, I think, Gregory, you cover this one. You got the best expertise here.
Certainly. So let's talk how businesses are valued, which is literally the million-dollar question with every seller. So if you look at the Internet, there's a spectrum of kitchen table approaches to very sophisticated approaches out there. And you want to make sure that you employ the right valuation model in taking your business to market, because you can cost yourself significant money. So an asset-based approach looks strictly at the tangible asset, and they can be valued on liquidation value to replacement value. Traditionally, it undervalues a good company because it doesn't take into account market share, competitive advantages, staff in place, customer contracts, any of those items. I mean, on a very basic standpoint, we've all been in law firms, and they have beautiful conference rooms. Well, to outfit a conference room is tens of thousands of dollars. Well, if that law firm closes or goes virtual, the liquidation value of those assets, in many cases, you're just happy to have someone take it away. So you're not going to recapture value. Income approach, I do not personally like revenue approaches, A, because they don't take into account localized information such as tax rates, payroll rates, occupancy rates, which can impact. It's also very difficult for a privately held company to project out what they're doing in 23 or 25. I can tell you that Addy and banks, when they look at it, are going to rely much more on historical numbers than projections. They want a buyer to look out in the future, but they know that crystal ball is really foggy. You can use a market approach in comps, and we use comparable sales in our process. But the problem with comparable sales is you don't have usually significant information. You don't know if the sale was predicated on health issues or a divorce or partnership breakup. It varies state to state. If you go to California, the same company as one in Washington doing $10 million in revenue, the net income to ownership is significantly less because they have a state income tax and we do not. So you got to be careful with comps. Our preferred approach is a hybrid approach. And I touched on this briefly, where we look at what ownership is earning and then combine that with valuation, in our case, six different intangible values to create a multiple of EBITDA and then intertwine that with market conditions, because different industries can have valuations driven by demand. I mean, one of my early industries that I worked in was mergers and internet service providers, the old ISPs before Comcast dominated the market. And they were fighting for market share and paying strong multiples, not necessarily based on the valuation or what their CPA or CFO would say, but they wanted to pick up customers in Skagit County or Whatcom County, where I did transactions as they expanded from King County. So, you know, to quote Hamilton, you want someone who was in the room and knows how the deals were made, simply to bring that into valuation. And you don't want someone just looking at the box score and saying, this is what happened, if they don't have all the relevant knowledge.
Yeah, good. Can you, you said it's often the best time to value a business after the corporate tax return is filed. What would be a good next step for someone who'd want to get a valuation or refresh an older valuation?
Certainly. So one unique element about IBA is we are a performance-based mergers and acquisition firm, meaning we do not seek any retainers or administrative fees until the deal is done. One thing that we offer the marketplace is a complimentary business evaluation. And the reason we do that is to build rapport with a customer. So we want to educate you on how businesses are valued, want you to, from a strategic planning standpoint, know what that asset is worth if you're looking for estate planning or retirement purposes to value that personal asset. And so, like Aaron touched on, and Addy would probably comment, the most important document in business valuation is the most recently filed IRS tax return, because you're accountable to an outside source that the information is accurate. So that's why we do a lot of valuations this time of year, and we have no problem with clients updating valuations. We don't care whether they want to sell in 21, 22, or 25. We just would like to be part of their team when they go there. We've been selling businesses for 46 years and plan on being there well into the middle of this century.
Yeah, and I've had some business owners put off getting a valuation, is they'll say, you know, they'll say, we're not selling now, so I don't want to take the time to do it now. Any context you'd want to share around the benefits of doing a valuation, like far before a sale versus waiting?
Well, you learn how the models work. So, for example, the clarity of your financial records to a buyer, their CPA, a bank, will enhance the value of the company. And so we see situations where people go to Costco and buy for the home versus buy for the business, or have kids on payroll as a way of paying for their college and supporting them early in life. Well, you want to clear up those gray areas, because if that dollar is being multiplied, let's say 3 to 7 times in a sale, the more clarity, the higher the valuation. So you may want to start enhancing clarity so that when you do sell, you get the maximum value.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think a lot of people miss that because we're all taught to, as entrepreneurs, to take as many deductions as possible, which saves you money on taxes. So say it's a $10,000 deduction, that'll save you, if you're in the highest tax bracket, $3,700 in taxes. But Gregory, what you're saying is then if you've taken that deduction, it's reduced your EBITDA, and so then you don't get the multiplier, the multiple in the business sale on that $10,000, and that multiple could be 4. So you're losing, you're saving $3,700 on that $10,000 deduction, but you're losing $40,000 in the eventual sale price of the business.
Exactly, and that's where we want to educate. And it's also strategically planning on what to invest in. Some things may be good for the business. You may want to update the website because that's the first place a buyer goes to look at it. But street signage is a very poor investment for bang for your buck. So if you're looking out and saying, I'm going to go to market in 22, you really want to make sure the 21 tax return, almost like detailing a car, presents your business in the best possible light.
Gregory, I think you had some comments prepared for this discussion.
Sure. So, price in terms of sale are the obvious components in a negotiation, but transition training, consulting period post-sale is another really important piece. It traditionally takes us 3 to 9 months to sell a business. So if you're thinking about retirement, if you're going to take 3 to 9 months to sell a business, and one thing Aaron and I have talked at length about is potential tax changes on the horizon where net dollars could be really different in 22 versus 21. But say you're thinking about selling but you want to retire, you may need to be engaged in the business for 3 months to a couple years post-sale. So you need to think through that negotiation and your exit strategy. As we touched on briefly, tax allocation, which impacts net dollars from sale, non-competition agreement, what you plan on doing post-sale. Many times my clients want to be consultants in their industry post-sale, so we need to negotiate the non-compete, so maybe they can provide guidance on a retainer or consulting fee basis that doesn't damage the company on how to take a consumer product national, where it doesn't matter that they were selling shampoos and conditioners with that product, they can apply that knowledge in a brand new brand of soup, which in the sale, the buyer shouldn't have a problem with that because it's not going to impact the business model they're selling. So there are many soft elements in the negotiation. And this gets back to what Aaron was saying. What's your next step? And many entrepreneurs have a hard time leaving the game 100%. They still want to talk business and be engaged with business. So how they do that in terms of the sale from transition assistance and the non-competition agreement can be as important to an exit strategy as the dollars they receive.
And I would even say on that side, in relation to financing, things like negotiating networking capital, that's something that we see very often where there's a certain point of time where that networking capital number is negotiated. Looking at a business that has seasonality and what have you, that can be one point where it seems simple. But if the working capital is negotiated during a peak period, it could impact the overall transaction and negotiation. Another thing that I've seen too is in relation to seller financing, maybe the buyer will ask the seller for no payments for 2 years or offer a discounted price if certain metrics are not hit. So there's always little nuances that can be done outside of just that ultimate purchase price that could have a longer impact on the business moving forward.
Yeah, those are really good points. And I think where we transition now is to the tax stuff. And since we're getting short on time, I'll shorthand a little bit of it. But we talked through driving higher valuations and factors beyond just the price that should be negotiated. And I mentioned it earlier, but business owners that are happiest coming out of a sale have also come out really strong from a tax standpoint, because while the price you get for your business is important, the amount you get to keep after tax is even more important. And we'll get into specific and tangible techniques for reducing the tax in the next workshop on May 5th. But the reason this is so important, and we'll cover more of this next time, but Americans spend more on taxes than they do on food, clothing, and housing combined, and yet put little to no time into proactively planning their taxes. Yeah, they've got an accountant that does the tax return, but the tax return's often a very reactive process, reacting to the year that's already passed, spending a lot of time in April looking at the year that's already passed. And the amount people are paying in taxes is more than ever, especially for business owners. And you may have seen these statistics. We share these a lot with our clients, but billionaires now pay a lower tax rate than the working class. And the way they're able to do that is the tax code is 70,000 pages. There's a lot of places in the tax code to look for opportunities. And the ultra-wealthy have big teams at their disposal that are proactively planning on how to get their tax rates lower. And that's something that we're helping to do, especially around the upcoming changes that are projected, whether it's the Biden tax proposals. And I'm going through this fast, but we'll spend more time on this next time. And so Biden's tax proposals are pretty aggressive from a tax increase standpoint. But even if they didn't get passed, a lot of people forget that the current tax law sunsets in 2025. So it's very likely some of Biden's stuff gets passed. But even if it didn't, the current law sunsets in 2025, and we have more momentum than ever in this country to raise taxes. Even in Washington State, we've got Inslee's proposal of an additional capital gains tax rate of 9%. And so you see these articles in Barron's and Forbes and Kiplinger's around how, yeah, it's a good time to sell because valuations are high, taxes are some of the lowest they've ever been. And if capital gains tax rates, which now are 15% to 23.8%, if they go up to above 50%, which would be the case if these proposals got passed, that's a huge difference in the after-tax net worth that someone gets out of their business. And the biggest thing that I will always emphasize in any of these workshops is that knowledge is power, but taking action is even more important. And this Picasso quote, to me, hits the mark perfectly, which is action is the foundational key to all success. And so we create checklists. We create a bunch of checklists because there's so much information out there, and we want to distill it into simple checklists that can be actioned on. And here are a few. We've got a few checklists for business owners, particularly around taxes. But one of the first things we suggest is an exercise that we call the What's Important to You exercise. It's a great exercise, and it anchors this whole subject around what to do next after selling a business. It's a series of questions we've authored that have led to really meaningful conversations and epiphanies for many of our clients over the last 20 years. Things like, when in your life were you at your happiest? Which relationships in your life do you want to invest in? If you died today, what would be your legacy? And if you could change or add anything to it, what would it be? What do you want your grandkids to be saying about you to their kids in 20 years? It's really a magnificent exercise to do with a spouse or partner or your kids or anybody you want to become closer to, really. And the next things I put on this checklist are more tactical. They involve ways to reduce your taxes for 2021 and beyond. And I mentioned before, we've got a few other checklists that we can send if you want. Just shoot us a note or put it in the chat function on this, on the Microsoft Teams that we're on right now. And the big one is the last one, is that if you really want to prioritize the business planning process and the potential exit planning process, we offer a free consultation. We can do it with all of us, with Gregory Addy and myself. And really get you some, like really distill down, okay, here would be the top things for you to think about in this planning. And this is from Addie, but another resource that we can offer, and I'll let her speak to it, but just because we're short on time, might have to shorthand it. But another resource that we can make available if you're interested, Addie, anything you'd want to share about the magazine?
No, it's just something that we put together on a quarterly basis. I'll post it to my LinkedIn page so that if anybody wants access to that, they can take a look.
Awesome. Thank you. There's that, and a few other resources would be, we've got some quick reference guides. So in addition to the checklist, we have quick reference guides, which are really helpful for business owners because we're all, you know, business owners are busy, and the tax code is complicated. For in a normal situation, but when you got a business, it 10x's the complication factor. Like, you just think of the retirement plans and tax shelters that business owners have access to, SEP IRAs versus simples and 401ks and defined benefit plans and profit sharing plans, and this huge range of amount that you can deduct associated with those plans. So we have some nice 1 and 2 pages, again, making it really concise, all these complicating factors on the 1 and 2 page resources. So those are there. And I just wanted to say thank you for joining. I know your time is valuable. You're busy. And to just encourage you to join the May 5th one, which is keeping taxes as low as possible. That's my personal favorite one because it allows business owners to make a massive impact. We've helped people save hundreds, if not millions, in tax. So that's a fun one. And then the June 10th one is also interesting. And then that's the one where we talk about transitioning from business ownership to the next stage. So appreciate your time. Thank you. Engage with us if you feel it would be helpful. Shoot us an email or engage on LinkedIn, and we'll be happy to share any of these resources with you. Thanks, Gregory and Addie, for joining. And we'll talk soon.